Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode,
that you could get quite similar mitochondrial adaptations from sprint training as you do from endurance training. People who are innately predisposed to running probably are more at risk. Very few people do only one thing, and if they do, they're probably not optimal. Most people would be better off slowing down a little bit. The social, psychological side of the training program is very important.
Welcome back to The Science of Sport. My name is Mike Finch, and as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. And our second episode of season number two of The Science of Sport podcast, or as we like to say, the real Science of Sport podcast. Because when we first loaded this up on our podcasting platform just over a year ago, we noticed there was one podcast called The Science of Sport, which we were very disappointed that was already up, and we had to call ourselves The Real just to differentiate. So if you are looking for our podcast, make sure you type in The Real Science of Sport podcast. But if you're listening to this, you've already found us, so don't worry too much about looking anywhere else. I've just celebrated, just a couple of days ago, my 50th birthday. I'll tell you, Ross, who danced some good moves on the dance floor. I didn't realize he was such a good dancer. And we're doing a podcast today a little bit about training. And I kind of think it's a little bit selfish of me to kind of do this podcast now, because I'm largely interested in how I can become a good athlete, even though some might say my best years are behind me. So I guess selfishly, I'm asking Ross to maybe tell me that my best years are still ahead of me as opposed to behind me. But principally, what we're going to be talking about today is the science of training. What's involved? Some of it's going to be quite broad strokes. We're going to be looking at things like intensity levels and how those affect your performance. And we're going to use the example of John. So John is a fictitious character who is very similar to my brother-in-law who works in our office with us here. But that's just a complete coincidence. John is training for his first marathon. And Ross, we're going to start this conversation talking about somebody. Let's say he's done a couple of 5K fun runs and park runs or whatever they are around the world. He's got a reasonable level of training. He's not particularly overweight. In fact, he's quite slim. He's done quite a lot of cycling in his life. And now he wants to run his first marathon. What does he need to know before he starts thinking about a training plan for instance, a marathon?
Oh, broad question.
It's broad. See, we're going to narrow it down.
Living vicariously through this fictional John is Mike.
John is 34, though.
For the listeners, Mike, who struggled to blow out 50 candles on his cake the other night, I was worried that there would be a fire hazard in the venue. So maybe the lung function that comes from the training John will do you some good also.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's a lot of candles, 50. I tell you what, when they're spread, it was more the ability to be able to go from one side to the other. And I think I took three occasions to actually blow out 50 candles. So
yeah.
Maybe there's a test. If you can, do you get to a point where the number of candles you can blow out? Because when you get to 80, that's tough on 80-year-old lungs. Is there a scientific test you can do around the number of candles versus your age?
Interestingly enough, The human body is remarkable in its adaptation to training, and we'll talk about that in this podcast. One of the few systems that doesn't change is the structure and function of your lungs. You know, like if you ever have a concern about asthma or any other breathing difficulty, you can go for lung function tests. You know, they do these like loops and they measure. You've probably seen this test done on television.
I've actually done them before, and I remember them telling me that I slightly. What's the word? I don't expel the carbon dioxide very efficiently, so I hyperventilate.
Yeah,
slightly.
And that, Yeah, and there are various conditions, emphysema and so on, where you can't get rid of the air that you had, and others where you can't get the air in, like asthma and so on. So, but yeah, it's interesting that one of the few systems that isn't that adaptable to training is lung function. So everything else changes, metabolism and cardiovascular system and energy supply and thermoregulation, but that's one of the few that doesn't. So,
your ability, the size of your lungs, is relatively the same. In other words, you can't grow your lungs bigger
within the narrow constraints of saying in those forced flow volume type loop situations, you know, that maximal exhalation and so on doesn't change.
But my 50-year-old lungs are not far off what my 25-year-old lungs were in terms of function.
When you are exercising, running a marathon, then of course your ability to use your lungs and to get oxygen from the air into the capillaries in the lungs, then into the blood and the carbon dioxide out in the other direction, of course, is better because all the other things are changing around it. But the structure of the lungs doesn't really change much.
Okay.
So the point is that when you turn 80 and there are 30 additional candles, you'd better be fitter, or that could be the last thing you ever try to blow out.
There's a great line, and golfers will relate to this. My dad is 79, and one of the great challenges in golf is, can you shoot your score as to your age? So if you're an 80-year-old, can you shoot an 80 and so forth? So one of the great sort of golfing challenges is to shoot your age over 18 holes, which is... You have to do some pretty good golf to do that.
Yeah, the two equivalents to that are run your mass in a half marathon.
There we go.
In kilograms.
Okay.
And run your age in a 10K.
There you go.
I would have thought. I'm just making this up on the spot.
That's a nice challenge.
There you go. So 50-minute 10K.
Run your age in a 10K.
Yeah.
So I'd have to run a 50-minute 10K.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be a proper challenge.
Yeah, and an elite athlete at 30.
But I could do it.
Yeah, I would think.
If I trained.
Yeah, and then your mass in a half marathon. So that's for a 100-kilogram guy, which is big. That's a 140. That's quite tough. But anyway,
we're just putting it out there.
Yeah, I've now avoided talking about John. But the point was that our lungs might be overbuilt relative to what they need. So your static lung volumes and things don't really change with training. But obviously, your ability to use them and get oxygen into the and so on does improve. So what John needs to do is he needs to capitalize on this adaptation of physiology to get himself into a position and a condition where he can then run the 42.195 Ks. So my approach to this always, and this is true whether you're an elite athlete or John trying to do your first marathon, is to understand from first principles working backwards what the challenges and the requirements would be. So we can start by asking the simple question, what is performance? In sport, and obviously our focus is endurance here, so we'll talk about that almost exclusively. Performance is the ability to avoid disturbances to homeostasis. Why? Because performance equals delaying fatigue.
Okay, what's homeostasis?
So homeostasis is a word that implies balance within. So they talk about the internal milieu of the body. So you think about your body and all the systems that are being regulated without you needing to think about them. Your oxygen levels, the carbon dioxide levels, your plasma pH, your osmolality, your body temperature, your blood pressure, all these different things inside the muscles, how much ATP is in the muscles at any moment when you're exercising especially. And your body is trying as much as possible to regulate that. When that fails and you are exercising, fatigue is the result.
Yeah.
So fatigue can be described as the loss of the ability to sustain a given work output. So whether that means lifting a heavy weight and then eventually dropping it because your muscle just can't hold it up anymore, or whether it means running 5 minutes a K or 3 minutes a K for 2 hours or whatever the case is, at some point your body says, no, I can't do this anymore. That's fatigue. So you either drop off or stop. So John's sole objective is to change the point at which fatigue happens in his body. Right. And he needs to get himself to the start line with some kind of training under his belt that will allow him to delay fatigue for the 4 hours, whatever it will be, that he thinks it'll take him to run this race. So if you understand what performance is, the avoidance or the tolerance, whatever, of fatigue, and you understand that fatigue is the result of a loss of homeostasis, then we can start to identify certain physiological attributes that he needs to address in the next, say, 6 months. Mm. Now, that's where we can start getting into the major detail here. But broadly speaking...
Just to take a step back, and I know I say this a lot in this podcast. How do you define, what is the action of fatigue? In other words, what fails in fatigue?
It depends on the context of fatigue. So when you go out and you run and it's 42 degrees Celsius while you're running, maybe you have to because it's Doha Marathon last year at the World Champs and you had no choice but to run a marathon in those conditions. Or it's middle of the day and that's the only time you have. Mm-hmm. The fatigue that you will experience on that day is quite different to the fatigue that you would experience if you are at altitude at 3,000 meters trying to run, which in turn is different to the fatigue that you experience running an interval session on the track of, say, 10 400s or doing a watt bike, for instance, session where you're going to ride 3 minutes at a high intensity or so on. Yeah. So fatigue is very contextual and it depends on the intensity and the duration and the environmental conditions under which you're training. So broadly speaking, if fatigue is the loss of homeostasis, then it can happen in any one of those systems. So is it running out of glycogen? That could be the scenario when you are running a marathon. I mean, you would have seen, everyone's heard of the concept of hitting the wall.
Yeah.
The old bonking concept where your muscle glycogen levels and your blood sugar levels drop because you basically run out of the substrate that you needed to provide the energy.
So now, in other words, there's not enough energy available to make the muscles work.
That's not happening when you go and run for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
It's impossible. You have enough to do that. On the other hand, running as hard as you can for, say, 10 to 15 minutes is likely to cause metabolic changes in the muscle. The pH drops. The ATP levels may decline. The lactate levels go up. Calcium levels, potassium levels, they start to change. And ultimately, the rate at which you give your muscles the energy they need isn't sufficient to meet the demand. So then what causes fatigue is quite different. So there's no single answer to what causes fatigue. Eventually, what happens is that your body, your brain, under regulation of your brain, simply fails to activate the muscle. You have that muscle there, but your signals from the brain change or are reduced and you therefore fail to activate the muscle. But let me not oversimplify this, you also have changes at the level of the muscle. And that's why physiologists grapple with this issue of central fatigue, where the fatigue is the result of something changing at the level of your brain, as in your motor cortex can't send the signals or doesn't send the signals anymore, versus peripheral fatigue, where you actually have a problem at the level of the muscle. And there's a guy called Les Ansley, who used to be here in Cape Town and has since moved to the UK. They did a really neat study where they showed that the higher the intensity of exercise, the more likely there is to be a peripheral component to that fatigue. But it's never all or nothing. So it's never that your muscle fails or your central nervous system fails. There's always a degree of change. It's a spectrum. But generally speaking, high intensity, short exercise affects muscle. Low intensity, longer exercise is regulated more by the brain. So the fatigue manifests in a slightly different way, if that makes sense.
So I mean, is that some of the theories around the governor theory of the mind?
Exactly.
In other words, the mind is what controls the effort. And once the body is put into a point of danger, the mind says, okay, we're not going any further than this. But actually, physically, you are capable of more than that, what the mind allows you to do.
Exactly.
So, is that proven? I mean, is that understood as a absolute fact?
No, but it's probably unprovable because I don't know that you can ever test it to its extreme in a lab type setting. But the premise of that theory is that your brain is gathering information from all these homeostatic systems. So blood pressure, how much energy do I have available? How hot am I? What's the temperature outside? Because it's not just about how hot the body is. It's also, it must have some ability to predict or forecast how hot the environment is, because the balance between the two is what's going to cause the problem, right?
Yeah.
What's the oxygen level? What's the carbon dioxide level? The pH level, not only of the muscle cell, but potentially the blood, because that's how it gets to affect the brain. So all these systems, and I've only listed 6 or 7 of them, there could be many, many times more than that, are feeding back information to the brain. The brain is then contextualizing and interpreting those in the context of the task and then changing or defending, increasing, decreasing how much muscle can be activated. Because on a hot day, if you don't slow down, you will overheat. And so the brain makes this prediction.
Well, because the body gets to a temperature where it says, if you go any hotter than this, you're going to have some sort of heat stroke.
But it does that before you get there.
Right.
So if it's 35 degrees Celsius and you go out at the same pace you normally would run at, within 25 minutes, you're hitting 40 degrees.
Yeah.
And at that point, we know it's pretty much lights out. You know, when you see these
spectacular... Which is a protective mechanism of the body.
Exactly. So that's a protective mechanism. But when you are pacing yourself, you try to avoid reaching that point in the first instance, right?
Yeah.
So you can almost, for listeners, you can imagine, take a piece of paper out and put a circle where you are now, anywhere on that piece of paper. Now, as you exercise, that point changes. Your heart rate's going up. Your ventilation is rising. Your body temperature is going up. You're depleting your body's energy stores. Your ATP levels might be challenged, and the body has to defend them. And eventually they go up, 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 and they cross a line. And above that line, you can write, here be dragons. That's where you want to avoid getting to. And the brain is trying to pace you in order to avoid getting to that point. That was the fundamental concept of the central governor theory, which I eventually did my PhD on. We called it anticipatory regulation. So because the governor, it made it sound like a black box, and it's actually too complex to be a black box. It wasn't like there was a distinct location in the brain where this little machinery existed to do all this. It involved everything. It involved motivation, psychology, thermoregulatory centers in the hypothalamus, involved the motor cortex, it involved conscious thought, it involved memory, hippocampus had to be involved. And so it's too complex to just say, oh, tritely, it's been proven. But I think it's logical, and you see it happen.
Okay, so let's talk about how these different energy systems work. John's marathon. All right, so he's got some basic level of fitness. Where does he start?
Right, so with the aforementioned concept in mind is that John is trying to perform by avoiding fatigue, which is the failure of homeostasis. He needs to understand what are the requirements of running a marathon. Now, the main thing, when John first goes and tries to run for 10 kilometers, and he's only fit enough to run 5 or 6 presently, he's going to struggle in the last couple. The reason he's struggling is because the stress of exercise, that exercise challenge, overwhelms his body's capacity to defend homeostasis. Where? Energy supply. So in other words, he can't get sufficient energy substrates to the muscle to power the muscle contraction, and potentially oxygen delivery.
Yeah.
As he then gets fitter, what is happening is his body's adapting to that stress via all these fascinating, amazing molecular mechanisms and pathways. And he is quite literally making more factories with which his body can produce energy. So it's kind of like the demand has gone up, and so his supply must go up. And the body's supply of energy is dictated in large part for him, an aspirant marathon runner, by how many mitochondria exist in the muscle cell. So you've seen this word, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They always talk about it in articles, and they say they're the powerhouses of the cells.
Yeah.
The mitochondria is a little organelle in which the energy for the body is produced, most of it, via what are called the oxidative means. So that means involving oxygen.
Okay.
And with training, and this was only really shown in the last sort of 50, 60 years, the stress of training causes our bodies to produce more of these mitochondria. The result of that is that we can now generate more ATP. And ATP is our body's currency for energy supply to the muscle.
What does it stand for?
Adenosine triphosphate. So it's an adenosine molecule with 3 phosphates. And what happens is, chemically, is every time you take one of those phosphates off, it gives off energy. And that's what your muscle needs in order for it to constantly contract and recover and relax, contract, relax, contract, relax. It costs energy, and our body pays for that cost with ATP. The problem is that ATP has to be regenerated. And if you don't have sufficient mitochondria, then you can't generate it quickly enough, right? So think of the mitochondria as a factory printing money.
Yeah.
And so what's happening in John as he gets fitter, as he stresses his body slightly more each time, is his body's literally making more mitochondria. Therefore, his body can make more ATP, and he can deliver energy to his muscles via these oxidative pathways.
And I know I'm kind of really drilling down here, but when you say this phosphate is produced, and it so that gets delivered to the muscle, that then makes the muscle contract? In other words, where's the energy needed?
It's already there. So when the muscle contracts, and this is called, it's called the stretch shortening, not the stretch shortening cycle, that's something else with the tendons. It's called the cross bridge cycling.
Right.
And so your muscle is made up of these little filaments, and they in turn are made up of actin and myosin, which are the two proteins that really do the business for the muscle.
Yeah.
And the actin, the myosin grabs onto the actin, and then it's called a power stroke. It pulls it, and that's how muscle shortens and contracts.
Okay. Yeah.
In order for that action to occur and for the myosin to let go of the actin, it needs ATP. And so the ATP, if anything, helps the cross bridges unhook, which is why when people die and their metabolism ceases, they get rigor mortis. That's because your body fails. It suddenly stops producing this ATP. And all of a sudden, your muscles are permanently contracted. And so that's really where it's needed. And they reckon that about 70% of your ATP is used by these myosin, they're called myosin ATPases. It's an enzyme that exists with this myosin. And so that's what's happening. So the moment your brain sends a signal to your muscle to contract, this myosin and actin interaction occurs. It costs ATP used at the myosin heads, and that has to then be replaced. And it's replaced through metabolism, biochemistry, right? That metabolism involves fats, carbs, proteins. But they work at different rates, and they provide different amounts. And so when you exercise at a high—
Are they providing to the mitochondria?
Yes, eventually, in most instances. So this is where it gets a little subtly different. So we have, broadly speaking, let's leave proteins aside for now, carbs and fats. We've got two stores of each. We have carbs in our liver and we have carbs in our muscle. That's muscle glycogen and liver glycogen.
Yeah.
We have fats in our muscle.
So for those of you who don't know, and I know that sounds like really simplistic for scholar you, Ross, but carbs are glycogen.
Yeah, so we ingest them. They are stored as glycogen. So they're packaged as glycogen. So glucose, many glucose molecules joined together make up glycogen. That's then packaged inside muscle cells and the liver.
Yeah,
that's where it's stored. So think of them as fuel tanks. You know, in the same way that a car's got its tank, we have four. So we've got liver glycogen, muscle glycogen. Then we've got intramuscular triglycerides. So that's fat inside the muscle. And then we've got adipose tissue, which is fat not inside the muscle. That's the one most people have a problem with.
That's the bit that I can see on me.
Exactly. So we've got two inside, two outside. So the two outside need transport. So we've got to get that liver glycogen from the liver to the muscles. We've got to get those fatty acids, is what makes up triglycerides or triacylglycerols, from the adipose tissue to the muscle. So that's a whole process by itself. But inside the muscle, we have muscle glycogen and muscle triglycerides, which can be broken down. And the long and short of this biochemistry is, once you start breaking down glucose, glycogen, fatty acids, and so on, eventually you want it to be oxidized, is the word they use chemically, in the mitochondria, because that's the process that eventually produces the ATPs.
And all of those things are oxidized at a different rate.
Right.
And sometimes, what you're saying.
And sometimes not oxidized. So sometimes we don't have the oxygen and we need the energy at a high rate. And what happens then is that we use carbohydrates independent of oxygen. So this is called non-oxidative. Some people may have seen this referred to as anaerobic. These days in physiology, they'll talk about it being non-oxidative. And what happens there is that those glucose or glycogen molecules get broken down themselves. They end up forming pyruvate, which is converted to the one everyone knows, lactate.
Right.
Now, that's a short-term solution to the problem. Because remember, the problem was the muscle needs ATP.
Right.
That process, glycogen to lactate, produces some ATP, but it produces other downsides for the muscle, like a drop in the pH, and that's eventually an increase in the hydrogen ion levels,
so that's
basically.
Lactate is that stuff you feel that burn in your legs when you're pushing the pace, it's a fuel.
It's not even that thing you feel in your legs. To this point, there's still uncertainty about what that burn is created by.
Okay.
It could be the pH, which isn't caused by the lactate. So this is where it gets, but you're right, that's what everyone thought initially, was that lactate was the poison. And that's because I think it was in the 1930s, might have been the 20s, but it's definitely within the last 100 years, The only way they could study this was they could take a frog muscle outside the body of the frog. So now they've excised this muscle and they would stimulate it to contract and they'd measure what would happen. And sure enough, they found lactate levels went up as the muscle got tired, and they deduced that lactate was the thing causing that fatigue.
Right.
But as the technology got better and they got more equipment and more tools to be able to look at this lactate and what was happening, they discovered that actually it's not the bad guy. And in fact, there's now a thing called the lactate shuttle, which is where your body is so adaptable that it actually uses the lactate produced by the muscles, and that lactate is energy for other organs in the body and potentially even other muscles.
Sure.
So it's actually a fuel source.
Amazing.
Yeah. So it's not, it got a bad rap. And I mean, I remember even growing up and reading magazines and so on, lactate was named as the culprit, and it wasn't. So when you hear commentators saying, oh, fighting the lactate, that lactate is actually, it's kind of like, it's kind of like the body's metabolism wants to go down the highway, but sometimes the highway isn't available to it. And so then it's got to take the side roads.
So it's enormously adaptable.
Yeah, depending
on the stress being put on it.
Right.
Right.
So it's a side road, and your body can say, all right, I'm going to produce a bit of lactate, and I'm going to accept the hydrogen ions and the problems that this might cause me as long as I can keep giving my body enough energy for the short period that I need it for.
Yeah.
And this is why when we exercise at a high intensity, this is where a lot of our energy will come from, is the non-oxidative use of glycogen in the muscle cell. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
What we want, though, to, because that's not sustainable. That's a couple minutes worth before you actually just have to stop because of that burn, which is probably caused, by the way, by hydrogen ions, phosphate, calcium, potassium, all the things happening at the level of the muscle. For John to get through the marathon, he can't afford for that to be his situation at 5Ks. He's finished. No chance.
Yes. So that's the guy doing the 800 or the 400 on the track where you see them tying up in the last 50.
Exactly.
Because the muscles have stopped working and they're fighting through soup, or not soup,
well, it
through
jello. It looks like that. Exactly that. Yeah. And that's why one of the most interesting studies, I thought basic study, was we just looked at the pacing and we found that from 1500s onwards, you speed up at the end. In an 800, you're just getting slower and slower. And in a 400, it's the same. And that's because there are changes at the level of the muscle. And anyone who says that it's all in the brain is denying the reality that you can see in front of you that this guy wants to speed up. His gold medal is disappearing and he cannot do it.
Yeah.
No matter how motivated he is, because the muscles have lost the ability to produce the same force.
Yeah.
And that's as a consequence of all this biochemistry that's happening in conjunction with this non-oxidative metabolism, right?
So John the marathoner.
John needs to avoid that situation.
Avoiding that at all costs.
As I said, he cannot afford for that to be his situation at the 21K mark. He's done. He might as well sit down on the side of the road and wait for the broom wagon. So what he's doing with training is he is increasing his capacity for oxidative metabolism so that the bottleneck never happens.
Right.
So in other words, he's making that highway so wide that he never needs to take the side road. I'm running with this analogy now, but I'm going to go with it.
I like it.
So it's like a bottle. There's a bottleneck there where if the rate at which you produce ATP isn't large enough, your body says, right, let's go plan B,
anaerobic, lactate. Yeah.
Dehydrogenase from blah, 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 and we go that way. What John needs is so many mitochondria that he can actually stay on the highway. And that's what aerobic or oxidative type training does for him. So when he trains, that's what these low intensity sessions were found to do. Again, they found it on mice 50 odd years ago, where if they overloaded them in these endurance type sessions, their mitochondrial mass went up 60, 80, 100%. So you literally double how much of this you can do, this oxidative phosphorylation.
Where do the mitochondria sit? Are they all over your body?
In the cells inside the muscles.
Okay. They're in the muscles.
Yeah. This context, they will be in other cells also, because any cell that needs energy is there.
And it's a density of mitochondria. So in other words, when you look at a piece of muscle in the cell, you can say there is more mitochondria in this muscle sample versus when you do a muscle biopsy, you can see that. Can you see that?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Exactly. So
in highly trained athletes, you would see a lot of mitochondria.
Yes, and you measure the mitochondrial mass.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, they can measure the DNA.
Wow.
But then the thing that really makes the difference functionally are the enzymes. So if the mitochondria are the factories printing your body's money, as they are, then the enzymes are the workers that do that. You know, they're on the conveyor belt that that passes the energy molecules down them. So what happens is glycogen and free fatty acids are oxidized. They end up as acetyl-CoAs or acyl-CoAs. Don't worry about the meanings and stuff. Those are passed along a series in what's called an electron. Sorry, they form something called NADH, and that's then passed along a series of electron carriers, and every step of that produces its ATP. So the enzymes in the mitochondria, the citrate synthases and those sorts of enzymes, they're the ones that go up with training, and that's measurable. And there's plenty of studies now that show that endurance training increases the enzyme activity.
So could you, I mean, in theory, and I love the way we always digress on this podcast, that's one of our signatures, but if you were a scientist and you took a muscle biopsy of a Eliud Kipchoge versus me, for instance, you would be able to see, without knowing who we were, who was the more efficient athlete just by
Other differences as well. I mean, the fatty stores in your muscle will be different from his, and
But the number of mitochondria that he has, the phosphates there,
His enzyme activity must be enormously high.
Yeah.
Same with those Ironman triathletes. I mean, So the end result of this, by the way, is that when you increase these mitochondrial densities and enzyme activities, your body now has a capacity to oxidize, is the word, or to use fat and carb at much higher rates than before, and in particular fats. And so you become better at using fats as a source of fuel. So an elite athlete is a fat-adapted person because they are able to take fat molecules, free fatty acids, and generate energy off it more effectively than someone who's not elite. So one of the things that will change in John, and pretty quickly, by the way, like within the first few weeks of training, this increase already starts to happen. And human beings can increase their mitochondrial mass by 50-60%. Other animals, slightly more. A lot depends on how inactive they are. If you take a human who's completely inactive, you can double it within a few months of training. And so
kind of training or any training?
So here's where it gets really interesting, and you would have...
This is the nub of this conversation. Yeah,
and you would have come across this in your editing time with Runner's World. There was a phase about a decade ago now called high-intensity interval training. There was a series of studies which showed that you could get quite similar mitochondrial adaptations from sprint training as you do from endurance training. And the reason this is the case, because it's true, is because when the signal to make the mitochondria, in other words, the thing that tells the body that there's an increased demand.
The stimulus.
Exactly. Very good.
Thank you.
is low energy availability in the cell plus calcium.
Right.
So you think about it. When you activate your muscles, when those muscles are contracting, they're involving calcium and they're using ATP. So what's called your ATP to your AMP ratio goes down. You have more AMP, less ATP.
Right.
You have calcium. Those two things are the signals that cause this mitochondrial biogenesis, is what it's called, right? And it turns out that high-intensity sprint training causes the same signals that endurance training does. So there was one famous study, I think by Burgermaster, I hope I haven't messed his surname up, 2006 was the first one, where they made people come in and do literally 20 minutes of exercise. And it was 30 seconds of flat-out sprinting, followed by a few minutes rest, times 7.
Right.
20 minutes.
Yeah.
And another group was doing the typical 30 minutes of low intensity, 60% of max type training for the same number of days. And they found
over a longer period, that low intensity stuff, same amount of time.
30 minutes per day. Right. And I think they tested them, say, over a few weeks, maybe a month.
Right. Yeah.
At the end of the training period, they found that the two groups had similar increases or changes in their mitochondrial enzyme activity. And so there was much excitement.
The high-intensity stuff, just to clarify, the high-intensity stuff is a shorter duration, but still producing the same amount of mitochondrial activity to the longer, slower training.
Yeah. So then the conclusion of that paper is that this mitochondrial biogenesis is activated by the same – sorry, it's activated similarly in two different pathways or two different types of training. And that gave a lot of momentum to high-intensity interval training because people said, well, why do 45 minutes a day if you can do 15 minutes a day and just go really, really hard? There are practical issues with that because...
That was my next question.
Because you take someone like, let's take our fictional John, not so fictional John. Like, I'm not going to suggest ever that John must go out and now sprint for 20 seconds at a time as fast as he can.
Right.
Because that's a shortcut to all kinds of other problems. And ultimately... come back to our original framework is, what is performance? It's delaying fatigue. What is fatigue? Homeostasis. John's not learning how to deal with a marathon by sprinting. He might be getting the same molecular benefits, but that's not directly transferable, right? Because at some point in that marathon, he's going to be encountering the 30K mark where he's going to have to use fat and he's running potentially lower on glycogen. His tendons and muscles have now landed, I don't know, 15,000 times each in the last in the last 2 hours. And that's you're not getting ready for that by sprinting for 20 minutes every second day.
Yeah.
So there's a specificity of training that you can't overlook. But what was interesting is that you do get the same molecular signals from going as fast as possible as from going long and slow.
So I've got this theory, and I'm going to throw this at you because I often get this question as the editor of Runner's World. A lot of people have never run at all. Say to me, how do I start running, doing a 20-minute run after a while? And we developed a program a couple of years ago, which was basically from the couch to a 5K. And the initial plan was to do a run-walk mechanism where you'd walk for 4 minutes, run for one, and eventually you'd go walking for two and running for three and eventually four, one, and eventually 20 minutes. The idea was that you would run slower and your body would adapt to this process. As a consequence of that, over the last couple of years, I've kind of changed my mind about it through my own experience. I've gone through phases when I've been off training for a while, trying to get back into running. And what I've found is if I go and do a training session where I'm running a little bit harder and then walking rest breaks in between, It first of all, it feels better to run quicker than just plodding along like you would do if you were starting a running program. But somehow I seem to get fitter better. Mm. And I get fitter much quicker that way, even though I'm probably taking more walk breaks in between that 5K. So the old way was run a 5K and run it slowly at 6 minutes a K. Now I'm saying the overall speed might be 6 minutes a K, but sometimes I'm running 5 minutes a K for 300 meters.
Yeah.
Is there some basis to support that might not be a bad option for somebody who might not have done any exercise at all?
Yeah, for sure. So anyone who hasn't run much before, like, is always better off with with walk-run protocols. We did a PhD study. The guys just submitted it recently, and we took a bunch of novices through 10 weeks to 10Ks. And the first 3 or 4 weeks, you're walking more than you run because you have to give the body time, particularly in running, to load and adapt to load. So like we mentioned, this is
musculoskeletal load.
Yeah. So we've already spoken. So we've spoken about mitochondrial biogenesis and how the biochemistry adapts to training. The tendons and the joints and the muscles adapt similarly. You load them and the bone density will go up. But if you load it too much, then the bone density actually isn't enough to deal with the load and you get stress fractures.
Yeah.
Or you'll get tendinosis or tendonitis, or you'll get muscle problems, plantar fascia issues, whatever. You take your pick from any one of, a dozen injuries waiting for you if you don't manage the stress.
So here's a question just on that. I know I'm interrupting you, but what adapts quicker? In my experience, your cardiovascular system adapts to fitness much quicker than your musculoskeletal system.
For sure.
What often happens with people that are reasonably fit is that they end up going too hard for their muscles and their skeleton to survive. That's why beginner runners often get injured quickly.
Yes, so that's absolutely the case, which is why people who are innately predisposed to running probably are more at risk than people from a biochemical cardiovascular point of view, because they are the ones who get better quicker. And they might struggle for the first week, but about 2 weeks in, they're like, I can handle 8Ks.
Yeah.
But actually, you can, your lungs and your heart can, but your joints not so much.
So that's an important part of John's process here, because there's no doubt that John has got some cardiovascular ability here, but maybe not enough running musculoskeletal background to survive going straight into 30Ks a week.
The other problem is that when you're a candidate for, let's say, a stress fracture or tendinosis, that doesn't feel anything like the same thing that slows John down when he gets to a steep hill and he's trying to run too fast. Because that pain is acute and it's instantaneous and it says to him, stop right now. The stress fracture develops over the course of 3 or 4 weeks in the absence of any signal. The first sign of the stress fracture is often the stress fracture.
Yeah.
So it happens in silence.
I know this well.
Yeah, so do I. And so that's the problem. So you often have to monitor and manage something that's not really there. You know, you're managing risk.
You get that dull ache.
Yeah, you're managing risk as opposed to reality.
Yeah.
So for those two reasons combined, adaptation speed and There's no instant feedback when it comes to an injury.
I mean, is there any way of taking note of that? In other words, is there any way of saying, okay, I'm aware of my body not able to adapt to my cardiovascular fitness? How do you check that? I mean, it's impossible.
It's
really,
very difficult, yeah. And that's why a rule of thumb, like 10% per week, become popular.
Yeah.
Because at least they give people something to work off. And I asked on Twitter.
Is that solid?
No.
As a theory?
No, not really. It's kind of like in the same burn as the 10,000-hour rule, because it might work in a typical person, but like in a typical population, 20% of people don't fit that. They're either high or low.
Can we give a guideline? Is it possible to give a guideline in terms of percentage?
It's so difficult.
I know you hate this question.
And since in the last 5-10 minutes, we've gone towards like this training prescription. And even we'll come back to your experience of like rather doing run, walk, or fast run, walk, and so on. Some people may do worse on that, you know?
Yeah.
Because if I know your history, and I know a little bit of it, is that you are quite comfortable at high intensity type exercise. You play a little bit of squash, bit of racquetball. You're not unhappy when it's high intensity, short duration, which tells me that your physiology is probably suited to that kind of stress and stimulus.
Yeah.
There might be other people who can just go and go and go for ages. And if I made them do fast, slow, they would never run again.
Right.
Because it'd be so unpleasant and aversive for them to have to do anything faster, whereas actually you quite like it. I'm the same as you, by the way. There's nothing worse than surviving for 35 minutes when I'm unfit.
Absolutely.
I'd rather feel like a Kenyan, even though I'm not, and run faster.
Just for a few moments.
Just for two light poles, and then I'll walk for two.
Exactly.
But like, at least I don't feel like I'm just dragging a piano around the neighborhood with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the point I'm trying to get at here is that so many people are different, that rule of thumb and guidelines invariably discriminate against a lot of people.
Right.
And so if I said to you 10%, and listeners, you may know the 10% rule was don't increase volume by 10% per week. So if I did an hour this week, next week should be an hour in, I suppose, literally 6 minutes, which A is like seems unnecessarily micromanaging.
Right.
But the problem is some people wouldn't adapt and would get injured, and other people could have gone 20% more. And so trying to fit individuals from a population into a population average is invariably problematic, I think.
Yeah.
That said, what am I giving you as an alternative? Because I'm not being particularly helpful here. I think, and this is the first thing I would make John do, is keep a diary and monitor his training and ask good questions of himself when he is training. Because as much as I said earlier that the first sign of an injury or a problem is the injury, that's not normally the case. Like, we like to think it is because we're too blind to pick up the signals that might have been coming to begin with.
Yeah.
So, for example, if John goes out and runs 45 minutes, the next morning he gets out of bed and he's achy and he's sore, and he goes for a run that next afternoon, and for the first 2 minutes, his calf muscle and his Achilles tendon feel quite tight. He warms up and it goes away, and he thinks there's no problem. But that tightness, that soreness, was potentially the first signal that he should have been paying attention to.
Right.
And so if he is mindful enough and if he is alert enough to listen to those signals, then he can potentially get ahead of the problem before the time. And if there's no problem, then he's free to increase. If he picks up that problem, then he might need to slow down or back off or limit the distance. So by being mindful and by documenting what you feel, how you recovered, do you have any unusual aches or pains, I reckon you can probably get ahead of most of these issues before they happen. So that would be my advice. I'd rather you did that than try and follow some rule of thumb about 10% per week.
So just to kind of pin that down, in that diary entry every day, or whenever that person's training, or they're doing it every day, even when they're not training.
Mm.
What are they taking it? How do they feel physically?
Well, you've got it. Okay, so when you're trying to, this is load management, right? Which is like the big thing, even in elite sport now. It's all about, can you manage load and recover and monitor recovery? So the first thing is there's the extrinsic load, which is literally what did you do? So for cyclists, this is real easy. 90 minutes at 205 watts.
Right.
Heart rate, 146 beats per minute, right? So the extrinsic load is the power output. For a runner, 6.3 kilometers, 35 minutes. Pace this, profile, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Then there's how did your body adapt to that load or respond to that load? So now we're talking heart rate and rating of perceived exertion during the session. So heart rate 145, rating of perceived exertion 0 to 10. Mine was a 6, I don't know, or 5, whatever it was. And maybe a couple of comments or notes. Then the next thing you want to monitor with respect to training is your recovery. So sleep, how well do you feel when you wake up in the morning? And do you feel adequately recovered from that training session? These are basic things. I mean, this is not rocket science.
Yeah.
And the reason sleep is important, by the way, is because there's this concept of overtraining where you load the body beyond what it's capable of. And when that applies to the muscle and joint, then it causes injury. When it's done to the whole system, it causes neural, hormonal type changes. And they eventually manifest as overtraining. You just feel dead. You're tired all the time. You just got no gas, no spark. One of the first signs that that's going to happen is a disruption to your normal sleep patterns. So the great irony is that when you're training too hard, you sleep worse.
Okay. Because
you'd think you'd be tired all the time. And you probably will be, but you don't feel regenerated as a consequence of sleep.
That's so monitoring sleep. I thought if you're really tired and overtrained, you'd sleep a lot more.
If you're in that if you're in that balance where you're actually training at the right level and are able to recover, you will go to sleep easily and you will wake up the next morning and you will feel revitalized. Oh. But if you don't, then that's one of the earliest signs. That and your mood state. So if you're married and your husband or wife says to you, why are you so cranky all the time? Pay attention to that, because they might be the first people to see your imminent problem developing.
Sure, fascinating.
So your profile of mood states, there are now established questionnaires. Many sports teams will use them. It's called POMS, Profile of Mood States. Those are used to try and gauge in an objective manner whether a person's mood is changing, because, again, it's recognized as an early indicator of overreaching, which then becomes overtraining. And that's what you want to avoid. And if you're not, again, this is one of those things, if you're not attuned to this stuff, your first performance consequence of overreaching and overtraining is what? You get worse.
Yeah.
So you try and do the same session. Maybe it's your weekly interval session, 10 400s, or it's on the bike, it's 10 3-minute blocks, whatever it is. And you can't hit the watts.
Right.
Your legs feel empty and you just feel like you're spongy and there's nothing in it, right? What's your response to that? Train harder. You see,
or you come up with a whole list of excuses. Oh, I didn't have my coffee this morning, or my kid woke me up at 3. So you don't ever blame your own body for that.
So you're so subject to biases.
Right.
You find rationalizations and excuses and you end up ignoring the signal because you overwhelm yourself with noise.
Yeah.
The whole point of monitoring training is to try and discern the signal from the noise. So if you are systematic about it, you free yourself from bias and you learn about yourself in a way that makes you more mindful and therefore better able to make the good decisions in the future. So the bad decision maker says, I'm performing worse, I'll train harder. And he actually accelerates his decline. Whereas someone who's wiser says, you know what, I'm training worse, haven't been sleeping all that well, I wake up feeling a bit achy, I actually need 3 days off.
Yeah.
And he gets ahead of the problem because he's mindful and aware. So the first thing I would make John do is switch that on, because John has told me that he doesn't know where to start and he doesn't have a good feeling for his own body. Let's learn that first, you know? And the great irony here, and I use the example often of when I was with the South African Sevens team, we used to monitor the players for these kinds of things. You know that after about 3 or 4 months, you don't need to monitor anymore because it becomes intuitive. And so the discipline of monitoring things teaches you about patterns. You start to recognize patterns. What did I do to perform well? What did I do to not perform well? I get injured. Can I discern the pattern that led to that injury? But what our strength and conditioning coach eventually realized is he could actually pick up in the player's body language whether he was doing well or not, whether he's recovering, whether he'd recovered from his transcontinental flight across 8 time zones, because he was disciplined in his monitoring. If he hadn't been monitoring them, he wouldn't have picked up the subtle stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting because we're all when we talk about training and talking to somebody like you, who is, you know, driven by data and heart rate and stuff that you can see in a piece of paper and probably evaluate quite easily, what you're saying is that your own perceived exertion, how you feel, is probably the number one reason you should be, that's the first thing you should be looking
at. Yeah, and it's the two things. It's the perceived exertion during the session, and it's the perceived, not exertion, but the perceived level of recovery or residual latent fatigue the day after the training session. And those are the two things. That perceived exertion tells you a lot, you know. And you can match it up with data. If you're in IT and accounting and you like some spreadsheets and you fancy it, then go for it. But my goal would be to actually take you away from the data. But it's like, I always use the example, it's like long division. When you're a kid, it's like you have to do long division at school and it's painful. You say, well, can't I just use a calculator? No, because you don't have a feel yet for how the numbers work. So you've got to do the boring, hard stuff, learn long division, because then one day when I give you a calculator, you'll have a feel and it'll be more powerful. So monitoring yourself and monitoring physiology, RPE, potentially heart rate and whatever else you want to monitor is useful because it's a discipline that teaches you about yourself, makes you mindful of your own physiology, and eventually you might let it go. But if you don't give in to that discipline, you never learn enough to stand without it, you know?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Okay, so let's just define these different energy systems that we talk about. We're talking aerobic and anaerobic. There's a lot of talk about how much training in endurance sports. We're talking cycling and running specifically in this podcast, but it applies to lots of different sports. Some sports you need more anaerobic, you need more speed. I've spent most of my life involved in triathlon and cycling, both as an editor of magazines in that space, but also as a triathlete myself and a cyclist. I've had a brother who is a professional triathlete. And my first access to sort of the science of training came from a guy called Phil Maffetone back in the early 90s. He wrote a really great book about heart rate monitor training. And he was kind of the first guy that did heart rate monitor training properly. And he was the guy that coached Mark Allen to multiple Ironman titles. And one of the theories that he had, not theories, but one of his teachings was that his athletes never did anything anaerobic. They were always doing things aerobically. So when you talk about anaerobic versus aerobic, we all know what that is. Aerobic is the easy below your FTP. It's you're using your aerobic systems, which is your slower fat burning systems. When you go anaerobic, you're going into your glycogen systems. And then that's kind of been adapted over the years. So Maffetone was all aerobic, never anaerobic, and he produced some outstanding Ironman level athletes as a result of that. There's a move now towards the 80-20 principle. You're 80% of the stuff that you're doing is easy, 20% is hard. I've heard people talking about 90-10 and some people talking about like only one intensity session a week. Where are we now with this? Is there a number that we know for sure works?
No. And where we are now with this is as usual, on a pendulum that tends to swing from one extreme to the next, when actually the truth is a lot more complex and a lot more nuanced than that. Now, I don't know Maffetone specifically. I know the name and I've read one or two things, but I don't know the training model. I do know, for example, Lydiard was LSD, right? Not that LSD, long, slow distance. And Lydiard was famous for putting his guys through these 150-mile or whatever it was weeks and doing this long distance. And when you read the way
people... And obviously low-intensity long distance.
Low-intensity long distance.
Right.
And when you read the way people would summarize or report on Lydiard, they'd report that.
Right.
They didn't tell you that Lydiard, at other times of the year, would have his guys do these flying sprint 200s. Because that didn't fit the that didn't fit the simplistic framing of Lydiard's model.
Yeah.
So Lydiard is known as a long, slow distance guy, but he actually had a pretty substantial element of really high intensity sprint work. I mean, Peter Snell, I think, was his guy. And you don't run those miles without some serious sprint work as well, you know, those mile performances. Similarly, when I was young, I read a book by Peter Coe on Sebastian Coe's training. And I remember at the time, not at the time I was young, but I would read these articles about Coe versus Steve Ovette. And the media liked to portray it like Ovette was this grafter who did these long miles, tempo runs, threshold stuff. Coe was doing these 50-meter sprints up a steep hill. And you get these, anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that you get these like reporting on these models that tends to actually simplify them and portray them as one thing or the other. And I don't know whether Mafutane is like that. But the short answer to your question is that training is almost always on a spectrum. It's never in one or the other extreme. Very few people do only one thing. And if they do, they're probably not optimal. Because the combination of training adaptations to endurance and high intensity is probably what causes the performance benefits that we're looking for, whether it be for John or for Kipchoge or for Wade Finikak.
Yeah.
So just because a 400-meter guy doesn't mean he can get away without endurance, because running a 400 involves a substantial endurance component. It's not the same endurance as John's looking for, but it's there, right?
Right.
So there's always a blend of ingredients, those ingredients being training intensities. So you spoke about FTP, which is pretty cool, because that's a concept many will understand. Maybe you can, I'll be the questioner this time, explain what you mean by FTP. And just by the way, for listeners, one of the things that makes discussing training so difficult is that 10 people will see a concept and it will spawn three subtly different interpretations of the concept. So one person's FTP may not necessarily be another's, but what was yours?
Okay, so I'll try and give you my scientific theory and then my sort of less scientific theory. As far as I know, FTP is when you start burning lactate. In other words, you're moving into that lactate zone. That's the kind of my science version of that. And you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong on that one. And my more theoretical side of me says that it's that point when you, it's if you're doing your 20-minute test on the bike, it's as hard as you can go for that. You're well into that. You're just short of that zone. So it's right on the limit of your red zone.
Yes,
over an hour.
Yeah. So it's a sustainable power output that you can keep going at uncomfortably but manageably for a prolonged period, right?
It's almost like your zone 3 out of 5.
Yeah, that would
probably. So it's the junk mile zone, actually, that a lot of people talk about. When you're riding that Sunday ride and you're sitting there at kind of not flat out and not going particularly easy, but it's like tempo.
Yeah, so there's various versions of this. And in the literature in the last while, there's been quite interesting stuff on critical power and critical velocity, which is similarly defined. And again, you listen, I've looked into a few of these, and I'll hear one person, an expert on it, say critical power is the power output you can sustain for 30 to 60 minutes. Now, 30 to 60 minutes is a big difference.
Yes.
Like the one's a 10K and the one's a half marathon if you're an elite runner. So like maybe we should narrow this down a little bit more. But anyway, this is the kind of concept. And you're right. So critical power or velocity or FTP, all subtly different ways of trying to quantify what is this exercise intensity that you can do for a long time. And if you go back to our earlier discussion.
What's a long time?
Well,
what's that number?
I genuinely don't know. Like it depends who you listen to. 60 minutes, they use an FTP 60. That would be a 60-minute functional power. Critical velocity is probably slightly less than that, 45 minutes. But I honestly find it confusing to try and figure out what different people mean by these things.
Yeah.
But physiologically, I don't think this really matters to you while you're doing it, but it is that intensity that allows you to get most of your energy, you're right, from those oxidative stores without tapping into your body's side roads, as it were, to go back to my analogy. So you're right, lactate production.
Is it non-aerobic? In other words, it's not anaerobic.
Yes, it's oxidative.
It's always aerobic.
It's oxidative, right. Yes. So there's this concept of critical power, watts, and then there's a concept called watts prime, W prime, which is like the size of your battery. And for any watt that you go above your critical power, you start to use that battery up.
Right.
So let's say for argument's sake, your critical power is 300. If you ride at 310 watts, you are eating into that battery at a rate of 10 watts.
Right.
And depending on the size of that battery, you will eventually deplete it and that will cause fatigue. So this is a model that I think is quite useful to understand performance with. So it's like FTP. So why are we talking about this? Remind me. Was we were trying to understand where athletes should be.
Trying to understand where John's training is going to be. We're right. talking about that 80-20 principle.
So, yeah.
So where is his training based on these theories around FTP and intensity?
So when you say 80-20, we're talking 80% in that really easy zone.
Yeah, what they call it, light and easy. In other words, it's fully aerobic.
Yeah.
And to go back to Maffetone, he used to have a theory which I quite enjoyed and I really kind of bought into that, was he was 180 minus your age. And people used to say, well, you know, 180 minus your age is a variable. Lots of people have different FTPs. But his theory was you were definitely going to be aerobic if you were 180 minus your age. It didn't matter how aerobic you were, as long as you were aerobic. So it was an easy measure.
Yeah, which is not entirely true, because I mentioned, you know, like the early studies looking at this mitochondrial biogenesis found that if that intensity wasn't large enough, you didn't get the benefit. So John, for his marathon, can't go out and run as slowly as possible. He has to run fast enough to still get the benefit, but not so fast that he exposes himself to the risks of injury and overtraining, right?
Right.
So
you can go too easy.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if he's trying to run a marathon. I mean, he's got to get himself to like a level. If you don't overload the physiology, there's no stimulus for the physiology to adapt.
Right.
The tricky bit, the art of coaching and the science, is knowing how much to overload, when to overload, and how much recovery to give it. So the best thing, I've heard various examples, like the one is exercise is medicine, right? The other one is that training is a vaccine. I mean, you're basically vaccinating yourself against fatigue.
Yeah.
But if you give yourself too much of that vaccine, you end up fatigued or injured. So you got to understand, if exercise is medicine, what's the dose? Don't take 12 headache tablets. You only need 2. Don't take 60 miles a week in week 1. Only take 10.
Yeah.
Plus there's the frequency. Plus there's the intensity, you know. Don't take the 500 milligram tablet, take the 100 milligram tablet. That's the equivalent. So what's the equivalent in running is don't run at 4 minutes, okay? Run at 5. So yeah. there's balance between all these different variables, you know, duration, intensity, frequency, and so on, type.
So for somebody doing an event like a marathon or an Ironman or an endurance-based event, the kind of training that they would do in terms of their ratio is going to be defined by the event that they're doing. So we know that an endurance event, you're going to do more endurance work. Is there any point then in doing anything intense if you're running a marathon or doing an Ironman?
Yes, because I hope we will try and tie this all together, because I know we've basically put a whole bunch of theoretical concepts on the canvas, but we'll join the dots and turn it into a picture by the time we finish here. We've discussed previously that one of John's main goals is to increase his body's fat oxidation and carb oxidation capacities so that he can produce more energy through oxidative pathways than glycolytic, which is the one that doesn't involve oxygen. So that's coming from that lower intensity stuff where you get the stimulus, you can go for long enough. It also comes from the high intensity. But what the high intensity training does, it improves, for example, your body's ability to buffer. Remember when we go hard, high intensity, our pH, intramuscular and outside drops, the body learns to buffer that so that it doesn't affect us as much. The calcium processes that are involved in muscle contraction are improved through high intensity training. Nervous system, coordination. I mean, you take a guy, me, I can't sprint to save my life anymore. I'm not coordinated enough. But with practice, I could relearn that coordination, and that makes me faster. So there's a neuromuscular adaptation that happens. The capacity of those glycolytic enzymes, you know, the ones that convert glycogen to lactate to allow the side road that I spoke of, those improve with high-intensity training. So you can't neglect the high-intensity work if your race demand ever involves high-intensity work, in my opinion, because you're not training a key physiological component that's required. So that's why when they look at what elite athletes do, they do engage in those high-intensity training sessions.
Even if they're endurance athletes like an Ironman athlete. When an Ironman athlete, whether you're elite or an age grouper, you're probably going to spend, you know, even elite guys are spending 8 hours out there. They should probably never go anaerobic.
No, they wouldn't do that. Be.
So
no,
why they would
unless they're in a race.
Unless they're in a race.
There's a need to surge and you need to increase that intensity, whether it's on the bike from 260 watts to 290 for 5 minutes. That might then require a little bit of non-oxidative contributions. But you're right. If you manage the race really well and you're not in a race against someone else, you don't necessarily need to. And that's why I think people get away with these more one-dimensional, let's call it,
in those events.
Training programs in those events.
So you could get away and maybe say that when in those endurance events, intensity, intervals, those sort of things don't really have a benefit.
Yeah, you could. You could, for sure. But for John, I would still recommend that he do some higher paced running because of the neuromuscular benefits, the coordination benefits that it gives him. I think it's enjoyable. I mean, if he hates it, obviously you change that. But I enjoy running faster sometimes. And fast is relative. We're not going to ask John to run 255 a K, but we might ask him to run 455 a K.
And I guess also if you have the odd session when you're running a little bit faster than you would do at your marathon pace, it makes the marathon pace feel a bit easier, doesn't it? If you're running 5 minutes a K for a 5K and then you're running 6 minutes a K for your marathon,
So what's the mechanism?
You're not maxing out on your pace.
So what's the mechanism there? The mechanism there is coordination.
Yeah.
It's the muscle, tendon, nervous system that you're actually adapting through faster running. And you're right, that effect is immediate. Like you go out and you do your first track workout of the year or the season, and within a couple of days, those easy runs just do feel different because you've learning movement patterns and neurological adaptations that make it better. I'll tell you what John needs to avoid, though, and I think this is one of the key things, and it came across, so many of you brought this up in your responses to my tweet, is the temptation to do all the training sessions a little bit too hard. And so you get neither the top nor the bottom, but you stick everything in the middle. So you know the old fairy tale, Goldilocks, fable, whatever.
Goldilocks?
Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
I've got a two-year-old. I might know this one.
You should, surely. So Goldilocks goes in there and the porridge is too hot, too cold, and then there's one just in the middle. Training doesn't work like that. Training's the anti-Goldilocks principle because I think a lot of people make the mistake of going too much in the middle and they don't do the low and the hard. And so you get almost like a regression towards the mean. And so instead of
a regression towards the
mean, like basically to the middle. Let's not call it the mean. It's not a stat.
Okay, just expand a bit on that. I'm not quite sure I understand what you're saying. In other words, if you're in that middle zone, you're not developing. You're not training.
You are. But you're stressing the system considerably more than if you're in the low zone,
right?
And considerably more often, because it's happening all the time. So let's say John's got 5 days a week to run. Because he's got family commitments. He's got a wife and 3 kids. If on those 5 days, every single one tends to be fairly hard but not too hard, John is compromising easy recovery days because he's never getting them, and he's also compromising the higher intensity quality days that might make him a better runner. And he's doing everything kind of in the middle. He's diluting his training to the point where he's actually just running miles and miles and miles at probably in the end close to tempo pace. And that's why so Stephen Seiler conceptualized and popularized this concept of polarized training.
Right.
So in other words, try to do more at the poles, either very easy, he calls it zone one, the green zone, or zone three, which is the red zone, but try to stay out of that yellow-orange bit in the middle.
When he talks about zone three being that junk miles segment
His zone two, right?
His zone two,
in the middle. The middle zone.
Right, he's got three,
So if you've got five zones, you might have five zones because your Garmin or your Polar has five. One and two easy,
right?
Five hard, and then three crossing slightly into four is in the middle. And again, it's not that you're not getting a benefit. It's just that the benefit there isn't matching the cost.
Right.
Because it's always quite hard. That's the guy who goes out every day as a 7 or 8 out of 10 because he just likes to push it. He's a type A. And I think I'm like this as well. Like if I don't actively force myself to go slower, then I don't and I go harder. And every single day is slightly too hard. And the consequence of that is that when you do actually want to go harder, you have nothing in the tank. And so your hard days become too easy. And your easy days, because your easy days are too hard. And so you end up conglomerating in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the thing you want to avoid. And so many of you in your responses, and I mean, I can't possibly do justice to all your cool all your cool suggestions.
Yeah,
because
let's just we're gonna kind of go to our followers, and I know Ross asked a question about some of the training advice, so he's going to go through some of that stuff, and then we're going to kind of tie this all together at the end, but go through some of those questions and we're going to critically analyze them.
Yeah, so Jamie got in touch. Remember, I asked you for best and worst training advice you've ever received, and these are often opposite sides of the same coin. So best advice, Jamie Langley: keep your easy days easy and your hard days hard. Worst advice: you have to empty the tank in every session and screw yourself to the floor. If you're not, you're not working hard enough. So this is the same concept. Just go easy some days.
Go easy most days.
Well, most days, yeah. So like 80% of the best athletes in the world, the best athletes in the world do 80% of their training in that zone one. You know, that's 5 out of 7 days a week. If they can and do their performances, then so can you.
And before you continue, I think what's interesting is what is easy. Now, for those of you that are confused about rate of perceived exertion, from my understanding, rate of perceived exertion, you've got a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being flat out, 1 being super easy. Easy is below 5. So it's that moment when you're kind of tickling along on your bike. You can talk quite comfortably to the person next to you. You're probably not feeling any kind of burn in your legs. I did that this morning. I rode with my son this morning. We had a very easy ride. I said to him, I'm feeling a bit tired from the weekend's festivities. I really want to enjoy it. And I felt we were always in control of the pace. I never felt like I was pushing myself particularly hard.
Right.
And one of the real big criticisms, I think, of the Sunday ride, particularly in cycling, and I think this happens in running as well, is when you ride with others, there's always the tendency to go much harder than you should, because understanding how easy is a lot easier than you think.
Yeah, so there's so many ways to do. The RPE for me is the best one.
Yeah.
Because it takes into account all the factors. If your two-year-old is up all night, you've got work stress because of your publishing deadlines. It's been particularly hot in Cape Town for the last while, and you are overexerted from trying to blow out 50 candles at the weekend. Your Sunday morning ride is best judged on the gestalt, the whole package of RPE. Heart rate won't pick up 4 of those 5 things that are affecting you. RPE will. So for me, always, RPE is the best way to do it, as long as you are honest with yourself about what it feels.
And this is coming from a scientist who likes to have things strapped to people's chests.
Yeah. So like, but I, again, for me, use the heart rate monitor for the first few months to contextualize your RPE, because you'll learn about your body by doing it. You know, I was thinking about, even in advance of this, I did track at school. And as a consequence of that, I can pace myself without a watch now.
Yeah.
Because all we did at the track was run 300s in 55 seconds or 400s in 74 seconds with 90 seconds, whatever it was. And as a consequence, because I'm measuring time and distance, I learned how to pace myself.
Yeah.
Friends of mine who didn't do track at school have no clue. But if they spent some time with a watch and a distance, they would learn.
Yeah.
I wasn't learning consciously, but I learned. Yeah. And that's how it is with RPE and heart rate. You'll learn to calibrate your RPE.
That's a great piece of advice.
In a way that your
great
heart rate. Yeah. So RPE for me is the best one. Heart rate, yes, you can do it. The other one is what you experienced with your son. You rode slow enough to have a conversation. Conversational pace is easy. At the end of that session, if I'd said to you, Mike, got to do it again, you could do it.
Yes.
That's the other test. That's the other test.
Yeah.
If you finish that Sunday ride and I say, go do it again, and you say, not a chance, then you've gone too hard.
Yeah.
So that's the asset, those three things, you know, conversation, RPE under 5,
and that's a very good way of measuring it, because I can guarantee anybody listening to this podcast who's an amateur rider, rides those Sunday rides with their mates, probably 90% of the time they're going to come home and they're knackered because they've gone too hard. So it's great advice. And my brother, when he was a pro triathlete, said that if you couldn't do the training session again, you had gone too hard. It was about being consistent.
And that's why the best thing we can do for John is we can find a group of people who run with him who are worse than he is.
Yes.
The worst thing we can do for John is get him into a group where he's the weakest link, because every single day he will bleed from the eyes.
I just can't find anybody that's worse than me.
Yeah, that's the problem. so many of you. Lee Savage had a good one. He says, best advice, you can't win training.
Yeah, great one.
You don't need to redline every session to improve. So that's kind of in line. So many people measured consistency in training, which is also important. I've always said physiology rewards consistency. So just give something always a little more than you think it needs. And this is particularly true, by the way, for people who are struggling to get over that initial hurdle of fitness. and they get despondent slightly too quickly. And I'm always so disappointed. I say to them, one more week and you would have turned the corner,
right,
and you would have been able to capitalize. But instead, you didn't have enough patience. You changed it up. And one of the things that we, because we can now jump online anytime we want or buy any magazine or whatever it is we want, we are so subject to rapid changes because they're always there in front of us, right? Just be patient sometimes. Give it. If you feel like stopping, trust me, give it one more week, then stop.
It is, I mean, I struggle with this, knowing this. You think that if you train hard for a month, you're going to see a significant difference. But in my experience, it's probably a 3-month process to feel significantly better.
Yeah.
But then there's almost a turning point in terms of weight loss, in terms of your fitness, where after 3 months of relatively consistent training, there's suddenly a turn, and then you get to another level when you're doing that. So I agree with that. And I think that time to get fit is a lot longer than you think.
Yeah, exactly.
It's 3 months.
Exactly. And we've discussed, hopefully, for people like the anoraks who like a bit of detail, that mitochondrial biogenesis is happening quickly. Yeah. Your capillaries are getting more numerous, denser, opening up, blood flow, angiogenesis is happening. So you're getting more blood vessels. Literally, you're building highways through your body to get the oxygen to the muscles and the carbon dioxide out and the energy to the muscles and so on. So that stuff's not happening overnight. You don't build Rome in a day, and nor do you build yourself into a marathoner in even 2 months. So give it time. Roger Homya, polarize your training. That's exactly what we've said. Don't get stuck in that middle zone where everything is 7 or 8 out of 10. Nothing's 10, nothing's 3. Rather make 4 or 5 days a week 3 to 5 and 1 day 9. I promise you'll do better as a result.
Yep.
Adrian Katz, build a solid base through consistency. That's what we've just been talking about. He says the worst advice he ever received is if you want to run fast, your training must be fast. See, that's the beauty of it. It doesn't need to be. Because John, who wants to run his marathon at 5:30 per K, does not have to train at 5:30 per K. Because when he trains at 6:30 per K, he's still getting that mitochondrial adaptation, that cardiovascular adaptation. His heart is getting stronger. His blood vessels are getting more numerous, which means that once he tries to run 5:30, he's made the space or the capacity to do that. He didn't need to go 5:30. Why would he not want to go 5:30? Because of injury risk and overtraining risk.
Yeah.
So you can get from A to B slower, but doesn't compromise the journey.
And potentially in that week of training, once he's built up some sort of base around his training, there's one run a week, which is maybe a 10K, that's run at that marathon pace.
Yeah.
So you get used to that 5:30 pace.
Yes, exactly. Or he does some intervals, some hill work, because he realizes he's got a strength issue. So this is where we would work with John, and we would say, okay, John handles the long, slow, easy runs. You know, maybe after 2 months of training, John is up to 90-minute long runs. Handles it, no worries. But when we send John to do a park run, we identify that he's not quite that strong there. And so now we say, all right, there's a spectrum. John does well on one end of the spectrum, not so much on the other. Let's spend 6 weeks working on that weakness. Not in a way that we undermine everything he's done. We still want to maintain where he's good, but we're going to focus on that. We're going to nudge him slightly towards that. And see, that's how we make the complete athlete, is we look at them and we say, and this is true even for an elite athlete. I mean, if I was coaching an 800-meter runner for the World Championships, I'd be measuring top-end speed. I'd be measuring speed endurance. I'd be measuring strength and power. And if I see somewhere where he is weak relative to his peers, that's the thing we focus on. Because if I fix that, he's better as a consequence. It's the same thing for you running your 4-hour marathon as it is for a 201 guy, you know? So, so many people, worst advice they received is no pain, no gain.
Which is everything our fathers taught us.
Yeah, let's see. Marcus Nielsen, worst, no pain, no gain. Best, have a purpose with every training session.
But there is some benefit to pain in terms of intensity. So when we talk about this polarization, there's no doubt that throwing in a session a week or maybe two maximum of intensity work where there is pain involved does give you an advantage. So it's not all no pain, no gain, but there are certain sessions when you want a bit of pain.
So this is where, again, it becomes a messaging issue, because of course, and again, like you watch the Olympics this year, not a single person's winning that Olympic gold medal without some pain, a lot of pain in training. It's a non-negotiable. You have to accept it. I was listening to an unbelievable interview on the Clean Sport Collective with Scott Farble, who's a 209 marathon runner, one of the favorites to qualify for the US marathon team. And he said his relationship with pain is an open one. He just accepts it and he allows it in and he doesn't fight it and he's just embraced that it's part of the fun of the marathon. So, like, there is pain, but Scott's not running 120 miles a week in pain. No. That's the key point.
That's the key point.
And so you've got to pick those battles. And if you don't polarize your training, then you lose the ability to pick those battles and everything becomes mildly painful. And then when you really need to go to that place where it's painful, you don't have the capacity anymore.
Correct.
Because you've just permanently been simmering. You can no longer boil. And so you have to learn, like, one day a week, maybe. Sometimes, depending on the person, one day every 2 weeks is where you really go for it. But the rest of the time, you don't need the pain. You get the same physiological adaptations from easy training, which opens up the opportunities to get to pain when it's actually rewarding. I mean, the worst thing in the world is when you're in pain running slowly.
Yes.
So, like, if you're going to be in pain, just make sure you're going fast. Ian Cassidy, best, learn to listen to your body. Worst, numbers are everything. So I hope, okay, we've bombarded you a lot of numbers here, but I hope you've understood that the numbers is part of the process, but it's not the outcome. It's not the objective. Pain is just weakness leaving the body. Best and worst advice, according to Steve Adkins, which is a good one.
Yeah.
Worst, according to Nathan Townsend, anything with the word sweet spot in it. I don't think we've done that, have we?
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the sweet spot.
Which that, one?
The sweet spot that I know is that one in that junk mile zone three that people talk about.
Yeah,
go and do lactate, a sweet spot session.
Filled lactate
just
threshold,
below lactate paradigm. Threshold.
Yeah, so you just got to run at lactate threshold. In fact, you know, I was 15 when I got my heart rate monitor. I begged my parents. I remember for Christmas as a 15-year-old, I got this Polar heart rate monitor, and I was, because I was like this, right? Well, I wasn't very good, but I was.
That's why you're a sports scientist.
And I remember going out and doing all these sessions and uploading this data and, like, I was trying to track and all sort of stuff, like the numbers and the sweet spot. And I bought a book that was on lactate threshold training, and I swear for 6 months, all I did, every session was in that threshold, you know, the sweet spot. And I think I got better, and then I got a lot worse.
Yeah.
Because it's just not sustainable, you know?
Yeah.
It demands, it's hard enough to be taxing and you can do it for long enough to be dangerous.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why you want to stay out of that.
Unless you're racing. In a race situation.
Yeah, of course.
But
then
would be fine.
Yeah, and then you accept that you might go well above it.
Correct, yeah.
But it's worth it, right? Cost benefit. That's the point.
Yeah.
Rest is a part of training. It's not avoiding training.
Right.
I mean, recovery. We haven't even spoken about recovery, but the good news is we've got Christy Ashwanden, who's written a book
on
recovery,
to this.
And she's joining us on the podcast next time. So we'll have a whole episode dedicated to gimmicks, gadgets, and good recovery. So we will come to that because it's absolutely true. Like, the key is not necessarily who can train hardest, it's who can recover best.
Yeah.
I got a message actually, not on Twitter, but it was a pretty good one, I thought, from a contact in the running shoe world, who I guess has discovered us because of the shoe issue. And he says, the best advice, I used to train with an 800-meter Olympian from New Zealand. He talked about what he learned from watching middle-distance Kenyans like Wilson Kipketer. And the quote is, the slowest runners in the world are elite Kenyans the day after a workout.
Right.
And the point he's making is that these guys, when they go hard, they go.
Yeah.
And when it's a slow day, they shuffle. And that's true. Eh? We bought 15, it was about 15 or 16 elite Kenyans, maybe 20, out to Cape Town in 2015 to test them in a lab. And I went running with them. And in these are 27, 28 minute 10K guys and 61 half marathon guys. And I was fine.
Yeah.
In fact, it was slower than if I'd run on my own.
Yeah. Now, that is an excellent example of what we're talking about, easy runs. These guys are capable of running sub 3 minutes a K.
Yeah.
And on an easy day, you can run 5.5 minutes a K with them.
Yeah, I mean,
which is our 8 minutes a K, probably.
There having a conversation. I mean, it was like a 45-minute run. And granted, the last 5 minutes I got dropped because they ramped it up.
Yeah.
And we went from running 6 minutes, 5:30, 6 minutes a K to running 3:30 a K in no time at all.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to sharpen their legs for the next day's testing. But the point is that they do. They really just shut it off, and they go slow when they have to, and that is what allows them to go hard when they need to.
I tell you, while you're going through these things, the worst advice I ever got was somebody telling me that if you're following a training plan, you follow every single day, and you have to do that, but you've got to suffer through the bad days because that's what builds your ability. And, you know, when you think about all those many years ago when I was in my 20s, I got that advice, sort of following training plans, you know, and even on those bad days doing those sessions because the belief was no pain, no gain.
Yeah.
I had a lot of injury problems with that. And if I just listened to my body and accepted that maybe today I wasn't going to follow the training plan, I probably would have been a more successful athlete back then. So
it's what's that saying? Youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah, something
and,
like that.
And then its companion is something along the lines of like, I can't remember, but it's something to do with like experience. Yeah. Anyway, it's like funny how I also now, my body's too old to cash the checks my brain wants to write. But if I'd known them when I was 20 years younger, I would have been a much better runner. Yeah. And I remember once hearing from he was a high performance director at an Olympic committee, a pretty successful Olympic nation. And they had two very good sprinters who retired, 100 meter guys. The year after they retired and they went off the program, so they weren't being obsessively monitored and coached and so on, they both ran lifetime PBs.
Wow.
And so he says to me, wow. He said these $100,000 investments and stuff that they made into these athletes were actually slowing them down.
Yeah.
And the moment we took the pressure off them, they got faster. So there you go. Amelia Boone, who we've actually had on this podcast, she spoke to us last year. She replied, she said her best advice is take a few days off now to address a niggle is better than waiting weeks and months later.
Yeah.
Which is, again, comes back to that monitoring concept because you learn what a niggle means through monitoring because often runners will run through niggles and have no issue. And sometimes they'll go through aches and pains and get an issue. And I think the best ones, the best athletes and the best coaches are the ones who can tell those situations apart because some of it is about going through discomfort, but sometimes you must actually stop.
Not many runners that don't have a niggle.
Yeah, but like you got to understand, like, what do I do about this? Is it serious or not?
Yeah.
And that's just pattern recognition that you gain through experience. And then Glenn Cottingley is the one who actually tweeted about the training diary. And since we've been speaking about it quite a bit, I'll tell you exactly his wordings because it was, as usual, quite good. His wording was, you won't see a benefit of a training diary for 6 months, which is true. But then the patterns will start to appear and you'll have data to compare to when you make changes. The longer you keep it, the better. And again, my goal with a training diary is to actually get you off a training diary. But we have to do it to earn that right. Yeah. That's what I would have said. You
know? And there are so many platforms available now, Strava and Training Peaks and those sort of things that allow you to digitally put these kind of things down. And I think to some extent it's kind of using those training platforms to give yourself as much information as possible. And, you know, seeing there's always notes section of all your training sessions. You should put down how did you feel on that day and monitor it. And you're right. You get a sense of when you should be taking the day off.
Yeah. Brad Burkholz got in touch. The best recovery you can get is proper sleep. We'll talk about that with Christy.
Yeah.
So tune in next time. The worst was changing my diet to get a marginal gain of 1% when my balanced diet was already better than most athletes.
Right.
Which is true. Like, don't fidget on the margins when you can actually change the fundamentals or consolidate the fundamentals. That's a key thing as well.
I like the balanced diet too.
Vishal Patel, fitness is gained through recovery. Yes. And number two, the 10% increase rule. That's his worst advice. And we've covered that a little bit, I think. Yeah. There was a study actually recently showing that roughly a third of runners get injured on 10%.
So 10% might be too much.
Yeah, for some people.
Right.
And that's why I would much rather you understand principles of mindfulness and monitoring yourself than blind adherence to a rule, you know? So, what else? I mean, there were some pretty funny ones. Where was that one? He got advice to run with 1 foot on the pavement, 1 foot off.
I hope you can find that one. And thanks to all of you that did actually reply to Ross on Twitter. You can actually follow us on Sports SciPod. And even if you've got some advice post this podcast around what we've done here, we're really keen to always share that sort of advice on our Twitter feed. So you can follow us on Sports SciPod. And there's always a lot of discussion around our podcast on that.
Yeah.
Did you find it?
A few people said I haven't, but a couple others is know the purpose of every run as the best advice. That's really important, you know, because again, I'm someone who does, I do tend to go towards the middle. Like I'll go out on a run and 5K and I'm like, let me just push this along, you see. It's because I don't have a purpose.
Yeah.
If I was training for an event and I knew where this run fit in the big picture, I think I'd be much more likely to avoid that temptation. But because I'm actually just running to be outside and I love running, I find myself pulled towards going harder when I needn't. So purpose is very important because if you understand the why, then I think you can deal with the how. Mm. So that's
why finding an event is so important, I think, to some extent, because it gives you some sort of structure to your training.
Yeah. I must find that one. Beginning. Someone else's worst advice ever was to stick ice cubes up their butt to keep cool. That's not necessary. You don't need to do that. Let me find that other one.
That's good. I hope we retweeted that one on our Twitter feed because I think that would be quite the kind of advice. I mean, it would keep you cool, but maybe not always in the right area. Well, while Ross is trying to find that, just to remind you, we have a couple of great podcasts coming up and we do invite you to be part of them. We've got a great one, as Ross has just suggested, with Christine Ashwanden, which is coming up in a couple of weeks' time. And we're going to be talking about some of the fads around sport and a lot of the things that we've talked about in 2019 we'll be covering with Christine. And she certainly is going to be a very interesting interview. Ross, we're going to wrap up very shortly. I was desperately trying to find the one about the pavement and running on the wrong side of the pavement, but I'm pretty sure that it's probably got something to do with the curvature of the road and why you need to avoid the angle of the road or something. I've heard that before.
Yeah, so Nate, so this is Nate Lirandi. I might have Lirandi lives in Boulder, actually. Hopefully I'll see you in May when I'm there. He's a coach and a former elite triathlete. He says, do the workout as intended rather than complain about it. That's hardcore.
Yeah, okay.
And then his worst advice is run with one foot on the curb and the other on the street to work on the push-off phase of the stride. I mean, that's just bizarre. I've never heard of that.
Just repeat that.
Run with one foot on the curb and the other foot off it in the street to work on the push-off phase of the stride.
Okay, so Nate, if you're listening to this, I think we need to get you on the podcast and get you to explain that a bit because I'm not sure I understand that, but maybe there is some scientific basis. If he was an elite-level triathlete, I can imagine he knows a little bit about training.
He said it was the worst advice he ever got and he never followed it, so...
Yeah, I'm just interested to know what the theory behind that was. Oh, yeah. So, Ross, to kind of wrap up a bit here, I mean, I think for those of you that are listening to this podcast... If you had to summarize like your five rules of training, kind of give us Ross's five, not three.
Gosh.
Is it too many? Five, six, ten?
Well, I reckon you could make 20, but.
20 is too many because we've only got 5 minutes left on this podcast. So the
rules of training is like understand the number one for me is understand the purpose of the session.
Right.
Which in turn requires that you understand the purpose of the cycle and the purpose of the program. So you build it up. It's like those Russian dolls, you know, you can unpack it as much as you want. But at a basic level, it's session, cycle, program. And if you understand the why of each of those three things, then you're in a good situation.
And stick to them. So easy to get tempted out of those reasons.
Yeah, but interestingly, don't stick to them so rigidly that you actually spite yourself.
Well, I'm talking about sticking to them in terms of intensity. So when you have that easy session, easy run on a Sunday, and you're running with your mate Mike, and he's pushing you too hard,
yes,
you've got to say, I'm not doing that, today.
So err on the side of caution.
Right.
If you think you can go faster, don't. And if you think you can't go slower, try harder. It's like, you know, you can always go a little bit slower. And I think most people would be better off slowing down a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? Unless it's that really intense day once every 10 or once a week. Then you must just pin your ears back and go for it, you know.
Right.
So that's the other thing is to avoid that regression to the mean, I think is what we – not the mean. That's not the right word. Avoid that – avoid bleeding into gray.
Yeah.
Like stay in the black, stay in the white, you know. Right. Stay in the red, stay in the green, but don't meet in the middle.
Yeah.
I think that's probably a second important concept. The third one is –
I love the idea of RPE. I think one of the most significant things you said today is that – yes, there's a fascination around heart rate. There's power meters that you can get on the bike, all those sort of things. And they all have value. I mean, anybody who does and trains seriously will tell you they have value.
Yeah.
But more important, and I think, and I agree with you on this, and maybe I don't trust myself in this, understanding how you feel on a day is actually quite a trustworthy way of managing stress and fatigue.
Yes. That is, I mean, monitoring. I said that for John's marathon, the first thing we would do is we would get him to monitor what he's doing. And it's not just keep a diary of what he does. It's to monitor how he's feeling. Like, you know, the aches and pains and the pattern recognition that we spoke about. Glenn's tweet, myself. So that would be like a golden rule of training. Again, and I know I'm sorry I'm repeating it, but it's important. Your goal is to eventually wean yourself off doing it like an accountant, a bean counter, because you want to be able to feel it.
Yeah.
But you won't learn to feel it until you do it. So you have to sacrifice and put in a little bit of time to first, you know, do the long division, as it were.
Yeah.
So that's a really important one. Then if we come back to John, the key thing is understand the end point. You know, like performance is the avoidance of fatigue, which is the disruption of homeostasis. So know what it is you're trying to achieve. John's goal ultimately is endurance, and that informs the training that he has to do. You know, and we've spoken, I hope people found interesting, the mitochondrial stuff, the AMPK kinase and the capillaries and all that sort of thing that make John a fat-burning machine when he's when he's running that marathon as compared to now. So understand the demands of your event. And then I think the last one is, like, it's easy to forget as a scientist, but, like, the social, psychological side of the training program is very important. We jokingly said that if John finds himself in a group of people who's weaker than he is, he's well off.
Yeah.
And if he's in a group stronger, right. then he's heading for problems. But that social thing is important.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to embark on a training program for anything without having company.
Yeah.
A, because it's just more fun. And yeah. B, because you can actually key off people. Now, sometimes you want, if John's doing his hard day, then I want him with faster runners. If he's doing his easy day, I want him with slower ones. And I would try and keep people off all the time. Yeah, to use people. They're using you too.
Yes, absolutely. So. Yeah. Or have people that are training on a similar plan to you of a similar ability. So if you've got a bunch of guys training for a marathon or a 100-mile cycle race or something like that, if everybody's on the same program of similar ability, and even if they're not of a similar ability, if they all understand it's easy today, they can wait on top of the hills, whatever.
Yeah.
But it is important, if you are serious about the training that you're doing, that understanding intensity is a very key part of improving, because otherwise you're going to improve, but not at the rate that you probably could do.
Yeah. And then I think the last thing is this consistency. Now, so many of you in your tweets said it as well, and it's obviously important, you know. And as I said, I think the mistake a lot of people make, whether it be weight loss on diets, training, whatever it is they just give up too quickly.
Yeah.
So they're impatient, and as a consequence, they hurt their own consistency. And physiology really does it. Sometimes it takes a while, you know.
So in other words, that 20 minutes a day of running 5 days a week is better than doing an hour and a half twice a week.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, obviously you don't want to get stuck on the 20 minutes a day. We want that to be part of a plan. So the consistency, again, applies to the big picture, the medium picture, and the smaller one. But that consistency is really very important. And try not to chop and change too much in the program, because I think the physiology, you know, when you understand the adaptations that are happening and the signals that are causing them, you understand that actually it's just a question of exposure. Give your body the opportunity to send the signal, to build the proteins, to change your physiology, change your enzymes, your mitochondria, your capillaries, whatever it is, your heart volume's improving. So many things we haven't even touched on.
Exactly.
That's not happening like flicking a light switch, you know. So you have to really give it a little bit of time, be patient, and let physiology change at the pace that it wants to, you know. So the art always, for every single thing, there's a counter argument. Huh? So too much consistency becomes routine. So you've got to be agile enough and adaptable enough to change the training program where you see that it's not necessarily working. But you don't want to do that in a way that like undermines all the consistency that you possibly can. So this is why fundamentally what John probably wants is a coach. Who knows these things?
But he can self-coach if he listens to this podcast.
No, of course he can. But actually, you know what? It's not a coach. It's an external set of eyes sometimes. You can just add a little bit of perspective, because it's very difficult. Even, I mean, I know all these principles, but I train poorly when I train myself.
Yeah.
And sometimes I need my mate Richard to say, maybe just do this. Okay, cool. That's because we struggle to. And again, listen to your wife or your husband when they tell you that you've been cranky and unpleasant for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's probably not a good sign.
Yeah.
And that's the last one.
Well, there we go. Great advice from Professor Ross Tucker. I'm glad we had some interesting, I think there's some principles here that I think most of you who understand a bit about training will say, yeah, I kind of know that, but you know, we always talk then, we always doubt ourselves when you talk about these sort of training principles. As usual, big thank you to Professor Ross Tucker, and we'll be up next with our interview with Christine Ashwanda on our next podcast. Listen up for that. Don't forget, you can interact with us at Sports SciPod on Twitter, and there's lots of discussions going on about that. If you want to add anything to this conversation, we would love to hear you. But for now, it's goodbye.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.